is Jim Setzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is a 1960 graduate of the University of Michigan, a 63 graduate of the University of Michigan Law School. He is presently the dean of the Massachusetts School of Law and a professor of law. Among his other accomplishments, he's written at least 33 United States Supreme Court briefs. He's editor of the MS Law Journal called The Long-Term View, serves as moderator and executive producer of four MS Law television programs. These, which are in several other series, which are carried by television stations nationwide. It's a great pleasure to welcome to the back to the show Dean Lawrence Valville. Dean, it's a pleasure.
Yes, well, thank you very much.
I am especially pleased by the timing, given some of your recent writings, that we have now the election passed, and I'm inclined to say thank God, even though I'm not a theist. I'm, in fact, an agnostic, but that we seem to have transcended a massive problem for this country is, I think, apparent to the whole world.
Well, I really think perhaps, Jim, we haven't transcended any problems yet, but we have at least put ourselves in a position to do so.
Well, I'm extremely interested in exploring that sequence of thoughts. Among the writings of yours that have motivated me to have you back now include your verdict on the history of Bush and your suggestions for a new Obama administration. I thought perhaps we might begin looking back, reflecting on what we've been going through here with this man who appears to have done so much damage to our nation.
Well, yeah, I mean, is there a question in there somewhere?
Yeah, tell us your take on this guy, George W. Bush.
Well, without mentioning names, because I don't think that he would want me to do so, I know one of America's most prominent historians who has been interviewed for CBS Sunday Morning, as have a couple of other historians, he tells me, and CBS has not played the interview for about 6 or 7 weeks now. At first, we used to wait for it every week, and now I don't know whether they ever will play it. They asked this man on the interview how he ranked George W. Bush among history's presidents, and he said, which should be no surprise, last, dead last.
Dead last, yes.
To which my reaction is, he clearly has surpassed, if that's the right word for going down, surpassed James Buchanan, who was the president just before the Civil War. An unmitigated disaster, an unmitigated evil. And I think illustrative, as is Obama in the reverse direction of something that's, to me, a very unlovely part of this country, which is, as Richard Hofstadter said 60 or 70 years ago, I guess, there is a terrific streak of anti-intellectualism in this country. And George Bush is about as unthinking and unintellectual as it's possible to be. Most of our candidates seem to aspire to show themselves the same. And the only person whom I have heard in the last, since at least Lyndon Johnson took office in late 1963, who seems to be quite the intelligent person, is Obama. And I gather even Obama has at times, if not in manner of speech or thought, but in the kind of good old boyishness, sort of tried to pander to the ignorant of this country, which is really quite terrible to the extent it's happened. But I think that Bush it portrays the absolute worst in this country. He's a male Sarah Palin. And Obama, on the other hand, is one smart dude. You know, Obama, I have written on this, Obama is the, he was earlier when he was in law school, he was the president of the Harvard Law Review. Now, when I was a younger man, 30 and 40 years ago, living in Washington and practicing law in the government and elsewhere, I knew a lot of people who had been on the Harvard Law Review, And I knew people who had been first in their class at Harvard, and since then I've met people who occupied the same high rung at Yale, and I want to, and I'm, much as I am an anti-elitist, and much as I deplore much of what Harvard does, you know, you can't kid yourself. The guys who are at the top of their class at Harvard and who are president of the Harvard Law Review or on the Law Review, these are very smart guys. You may not agree with them about things, they are, but they are very smart guys. Obama was president of the Harvard Law Review, and he is in the campaign as well. He showed himself a very smart guy. Whereas most of the rest of the presidents we've had are, frankly speaking, been sort of mental clods and proud of it. And although, and although it will surprise people, I have never thought, I have reasons for it, I have never thought either Bill or Hillary Clinton are particularly smart people.
Well, that's very interesting, because Bill, of course, is a Rhodes Scholar, among his other achievements.
That's right. That's right. And she's regarded as very smart. And I have talked to a Harvard professor who has spoken to Hillary Clinton and thought she's a very smart person. I just don't buy it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the ultimate heresy, I guess. So, anyway, I think that George Bush represented unmitigated evil, unmitigated anti-intellectualism, and generally is a very bad human being, who incidentally just also ruined it for Jeb, big deal, but he did in fact. Well, Barack Obama strikes me as probably the smartest guy to run for and win the presidency in at least 44 years.
Yeah,
maybe more.
Yes, yes. You know, Dean, what's growing on me, and I've done a huge amount of research on JFK in particular in relation to his assassination, but how much Obama reminds me of JFK, I never thought in my life I would offer such an opinion about another president of the United States. But it appears to me that Obama and JFK share many virtues.
Well, I expect that that's true. Although I have to say one thing that people tend too quickly to dismiss with regards to JFK, and I find myself unable to, is that he had a lot of what he is credited with it was pretty plainly done by Ted Sorensen. And Sorensen tries to evade this in his recent autobiography. He evades it. He mealy-mouths it. He tries to say that in various ways that the credit does belong to John Kennedy for various reasons. But, you know, at the end of the day, Sorensen was responsible for an awful lot of what Kennedy took credit for. There
well,
is
it's
one thing
I just spoke at a conference on the legacy of JFK where Ted Sorensen also spoke in North Dakota. And I share a lot of those sentiments, particularly in terms of the writing of his speeches, the articulation of his ideas. But we must give Jack credit for choosing such an excellent person to be such in such close proximity, such that, for example, as a Marine Corps officer, we're responsible for everything our men do or fail to do. And in this case, I'd say the president's responsible for everything his staff does or fails to do, including, of course, Ted Sorensen.
Well, I think that's an excellent point. It is a talent to be a good chooser of men and women, a good chooser of subordinates.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Dean Lawrence Bell.
Are you tired of searching for Freak Talk Radio? Well, search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Hey, Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is the author of a book dealing with constitutional aspects of the Vietnam War, at least 17 law review articles and 23 articles for legal and daily newspapers, who has written at least 33 United States Supreme Court briefs. He is the dean of the Massachusetts School of Law, Lawrence Velville. Dean, again, it's such a pleasure to have you here. I'd like to quote from someone I think is one of your favorite authors. It may take 25 or 50 years, but it is almost certain that one day this character will be exhibit number one for the danger of having a nut job in the Oval Office, says Lawrence Velville, dean of the Massachusetts School of Law at Andover, writing in his latest book, An Enemy of the People. Velville said, in everyday life, someone who refuses to recognize the actual facts of the world around him and who instead lives in a dream world in his head is regarded as not being sane, as being, to use the blunt words, insane or crazy. Why is it different when it is a national leader who refuses to recognize facts in the world and instead lives in a dream world in his head?
I don't know that I think the author is one of my favorite authors.
Well, you show extreme detachment and objectivity.
I'll take that as an insult.
The book, I take it, is quite new, is it not? The Enemy, an Enemy of the People? It sounds fascinating.
Well, it's the title is taken from a famous Ibsen play in which an individual thought he was doing good for society, but society thought that he was doing evil and ostracized him to his shock and horror. The book is about, well, it's a collection of blog postings that I did in 2006. And it covers a whole variety of subjects, the economy to some extent, George Bush, the war, other things. My favorite part about it is I think I have one or maybe two very long articles in there about Michigan football.
And,
yeah, and that was the best part of the whole thing because although I live in the Boston area, I attended Michigan's second game last year after their loss to Appalachian State when they lost to Oregon. And it was a fraternity reunion. We had an absolute blast that led to a lot of what I thought was pretty funny writing. And just the other day, I wrote another piece about this year's Michigan football. But it covers a wide variety. The book and the blog postings cover a wide variety of interests. By the way, you're located up in Minnesota, so I think, is it this Saturday or next Saturday when you folks are going to feast on the Wolverines?
Well, actually, I'm now in Madison, Wisconsin, where I have retired. My daughter and the son-in-law both graduated from Wisconsin, so I've been rooting for the Badgers, but they've had a really bad season, Dean. They lost three or four games where they should have prevailed.
Yes, and I saw the first one of those, which was the Michigan game in Ann Arbor, where they were ahead 19-0 at the half.
That's right. Yeah. That's exactly right. Let me read another passage from this author where he appears to agree with Jerome Frank, who wrote a book entitled Bush on the Couch, Frank being a noted psychiatrist. Velville goes on to say, quote, most interesting is the idea that Bush suffers from a condition called dry drunk. Essentially, this means that even if one eventually stops drinking, as Bush did, years of alcoholism cause irreversible damage to brain chemistry. Results of this damage, including such Bushian traits as rigid judgmentalism, irritability, impatience, grandiosity, obsessive thought patterns, incoherent speech, and other unlovely characteristics, which, of course, we've noticed in him repeatedly for all these years.
Yeah. Well, you know, somebody would have a right to ask, how the hell does this guy who's a law school dean know about psychiatry and the symptoms of being a dry drunk and so forth? Well, of course, I don't know anything of my own accord, but I have been reading, when I was writing these things, I read a fair amount by psychiatrists and psychologists who were assessing Bush. Now, you know, one of the questions which arises when people, which arose when people did that, is how can you make a psychiatric judgment of Bush from a distance. Isn't that like a doctor making a medical diagnosis of somebody from a distance? Well, in point of fact, the governmental agencies use psychiatrists to make precisely those kinds of assessments of foreign leaders because it helps our governmental people. It sheds light for our governmental people on what they might expect from foreign leaders. So it's not a totally unknown phenomenon, and it's, at least our government does not think of it as being ipso facto unuseful or almost ipso facto incorrect. As I say, these ideas did not come from me because I don't know any psychiatry, but they came from reading people who were psychiatrists.
Well, coincidentally, I recently had a visit from a prominent psychiatrist who's based in Washington, and among other conversations between us, his views of Bush coincide very closely to yours. And I think anyone who's been observing this man, and unfortunately we've all had no choice in that regard for 8 years now, I think that anyone who's attentive to human characteristics and personalities is going to arrive at very similar conclusions.
Yeah. You know, the amazing, the really terrible thing is raised by the question, how did a man like this get to be president of the United States? Now, you know, we all know part of the answer. He was a Bush. The Republicans were desperate to have a winner, and they thought somebody carrying the Bush name might do that. They had access to money. He had a very shrewd, maybe one of the history's shrewdest campaign gurus, Karl Rove. Even if the guy is unmitigatedly evil and immoral, he is politically shrewd. And I think he is unmitigatedly evil and immoral, but he is shrewd. So there were ways in which that this happened. And, of course, something that played an enormous role was the good old boyism. And that seems to me to be a fundamental problem in this country. It's one of the reasons why Obama's victory is even the more amazing, because John McCain is the very epitome of a good old boy, a fellow you'd like to have a beer with, an absolutely charming guy. And these kinds of people have been ruining this country. But they are the kinds of people who Americans, previous to this election, and maybe again in subsequent years, will vote for. The kind of people Americans voted for previous to this election.
We'll be right back with my special guest, Dean Belville.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Don't you know that you can count me out?
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is the editor of the Massachusetts Law Journal called The Long-Term View, and serves as a moderator and executive producer of four Massachusetts Law television programs, the Legal Series Educational Forum, the Topical Issues in the News, and the book discussion show, Books of Our Time, which are carried by television stations nationwide, Dean Lawrence Belville of the University of Massachusetts School of Law. Dean, just looking at the book Bush on the Couch, I realize I misstated the first name of the psychiatrist, Frank. It's Justin. I've got two books here that I read recently. One, A Boy Genius. You mentioned Karl Rove. And on the cover, there's a picture of Bush and a picture of Rove, and under Bush it says boy, and under Rove it says genius. In a book by Jacob Weisberg entitled The Bush Tragedy, and of course also we have the new film by Oliver Stone, W, which seems to me to be an extremely charitable interpretation of his history. As you were raising the relevant question, how could someone as incompetent as this, I would even go so far as to say as corrupt as this, as utterly lacking in empathy, sympathy, knowledge, intelligence, you know, could ever become president of the United States? I think it's a devastating indictment of our political system that a catastrophe like this could occur.
Well, I agree. I suppose one could say that Sarah Palin was the same, and she almost made the vice presidency, or at least she became a candidate. Bush was, he was a drunk. That's conceded. He was a failure in business. He was a failure as the owner of a baseball team. His success there was attributable solely to the fact that they sold out because of political things. They managed to sell out at a profit. He wasn't terribly much as a governor. But I'll tell you something that has not generally been bruited about. It's not exactly germane to the fact of Bush's incompetence, but it's, on the other hand, maybe it's not irrelevant either. You know, I'm part of a generation. I'm 69 years old. I am part of the only generation in American history that did not have a president. And Bush is relevant to that because had McCain won in the year 2000, had he won the Republican nomination, there would have been a president from our generation, too. And Bush and Rove crucified McCain by what they did, all the rumors, the lies, the frauds they spread in South Carolina. And it is curious that there is a generation which has been bypassed. I think there are reasons for it that have to do with the silent, what was called the silent generation of the 50s, the disgust with politics that grew up, the focus on money-making that was so prevalent after World War II. There's one reason and another for this. It's very unusual. The last chance was either McCain or Lieberman, and both of them became complete busts. Instead of somebody who, the year 2000, like McCain, who was a fairly decent person then, instead of him being a person from our generation to become president, he lost, and this idiot won. So there is some relationship, I guess, between this unremarked phenomenon, which I have remarked in a book, and Sam Tannenhaus remarked in an article he wrote on McCain a couple of months ago. Sam Tannenhaus is the editor of the New York Times Book Review, and I've forgotten exactly where he wrote the article, but he mentioned this fact about the generational gap. And, in fact, what he said paralleled what I said in terms of not only logic and facts, but the very structure of argument so closely that a journalism guy I knew was absolutely persuaded that he had plagiarized. And I got in touch with Tannenhaus. No, this was serious because I got in touch with Tannenhaus. I didn't, by the way, I didn't think he plagiarized because I think that the facts, if when one looks at this, are obvious and all people would see it the same way. Although the structure of the argument, that was a little more odd, perhaps. But Tannenhaus vigorously denied that he plagiarized it, and I have no reason to think he's not telling the truth. So as far as I know, there are only two of us who have ever commented on this rather unusual fact of generational skippage. Now, if you ask, what do I include as a generation, it goes something like this. How did I put it? The last, 1946. Oh, no, nobody born between the years 1925, I think it is, and 1946 has been president. And that's a 20-year stretch, or maybe it's 1923, a 22-year stretch.
That's quite a chunk of time.
you will not find another example of that in American history.
Now, you and I are very near contemporaries. I was born in 1940. I'll be 68 this year. I graduated from Princeton in 62. And I think that one of the benefits of our generation, Dean, and why persons of that group would have made an excellent president has to do with the lack of the being submerged in television. I mean, we only had our first television when I was about 11 years old, and it really didn't make much of a difference in my life. Even all the way through high school, I seldom spent any time watching television programs, though my younger brothers and sisters actually were very much immersed in it. So I think there's an advantage to having developed intellectually without being submerged in television.
Well, you know, Jim, I am sure you're right. I, of course, deal, and my colleagues who are in their early to mid-50s deal on a regular basis. They even more than I, because they teach, I don't, with people who are the products of the television era and now increasingly products of the Internet era. You know, we see a lot of concrete examples, dislike for reading, a desire that people come to the point immediately, unwillingness to consider the full ramifications and relevant digressions of relevant to an argument. There is a huge difference, apparently, intellectually, between those of us who grew up basically before television and people who grew up after television, and people, scientists who study these things, you know, brain waves, neuroscientists, do indeed find the differences in the way people's brains operate when they're reading a book as opposed to, say, watching television or being on the Internet. And they find real intellectual differences between those of us who grew up with book learning, so to speak.
I think that's absolutely right. I did a course on the science and pseudoscience that I introduced at the University of Minnesota. And in dealing with you know, issues about psychokinesis, it was pointed out that the brainwave activity when you're watching television is even lower than when you're in deep sleep.
Well,
I mean, that's absolutely
deeper, maybe you're in deeper sleep when you watch television.
amazing stuff. Well, I love these quotes from your book. I want to mention just a couple more. With regard to the specific analysis of Bush, there seems to be wide agreement that Bush is a sociopath, defined, one gathers, as someone who feels no empathy with others, who cannot feel for others, who does not feel a care for their pain, to use Clintonian jargon. That Bush is utterly devoid of empathy seems plainly true to me, unlike Lincoln or even lying Lyndon Johnson, who sent people to their deaths but agonized over it. Bush is thought by the shrinks and appears to lay eye to give not one damn about how many Americans he kills, let alone Iraqis. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Dean Lawrence Belville of the University of Massachusetts School of Law.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help. You know, I need someone.
Help!
When I was younger, so much younger than today,
I never needed
anybody's help in any way. But now these days are gone, and I'm not so self-assured.
Now I
find a change of mind, I'll open up the doors. Help me if you can, I'm feeling down.
Jim Stepney, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today has been a partner in major law firms in Washington, D.C., and was the first chief counsel of an organization established to write United States Supreme Court briefs in support of state and local governments. He's been active in Supreme Court litigation, constitutional law, antitrust law, and complex litigation. You've been covering a lot of territory, Dean Belville, of the University of Massachusetts School of Law.
Right. Well, I sometimes wonder whether I spread myself too thin, you know.
That's not my impression, if I may say. I think you have a depth of understanding of virtually every issue that you confront. My heart was in my throat during this election, Dean, because I was so concerned that they were going to use the electronic voting machines to steal it. It seemed to me they were overwhelmingly motivated. I think there's a lot of latent racism on the far right, and I think that even though Bush personally may be an exception, I think this was something that probably didn't go down well. They had a guy who would be kind of a more extreme version of Bush in John McCain. I even wrote a piece about McCain that anyone can find on Google. John McCain, morally, mentally, and emotionally unfit, where I laid out the case against him. But I was terribly, terribly concerned, especially because I've had a series of experts on election fraud come on this program, and we've discussed especially what happened in Ohio in 2004. But it's quite evident that as far back as 2002 with Max Cleland, 2004, and even 2006, they were using these machines to steal elections. And now it appears there's funny business going on in Alaska, that because the state is so small, it's quite visible. And in fact, I'm inviting an expert on election theft and someone who's prominent in Alaska and keeping tabs of what's going on to join us during the second hour, so we can talk about it, because I want to get your reaction to this and what you think might be done about it.
Right. Well, you know, one thing that you mentioned in passing has always resonated with me. Max Cleland.
Yeah.
Max Cleland lost three out of his four limbs in NAM, if I remember correctly.
Yes, you're correct.
And was defeated by a guy who, let's face it, has to be the scum of the earth to say what he said, that Max Cleland was not a patriot.
I don't care. Disgusting. This is Shambliss, of course.
I don't know that I've ever heard anything worse than that. And that epitomizes, I mean, it's the epitome of far right. Well, I can't use the word on a radio program. You know what I mean?
Well, extremism is a pretty good approximation. Yeah.
Fanaticism.
I know. It's disgusting. I mean, talk about anti-intellectual, uninformed, you know, lacking empathy or understanding, incapacity to see the world from another person's point of view. I think these all typify right-wing extremists.
Right, right. And, you know, in regard to Chambliss in particular, how can you be so crass?
Yeah.
To say that somebody who lost three out of his four limbs fighting for your country lacks patriotism. How can you do that? I mean, just how bad are politicians?
Well, I'm happy to say that at the very least, and I have had the two experts on this week already talking about this this election, and one, Mark Adams, will be joining us the second hour, are of the opinion that they were used to diminish the impact of the massive outpouring of support for Barack Obama and to make it appear as though it was a much lesser in its extent and save House seats and Senate positions. I'm happy that in Georgia, Chambliss did not get 50% and therefore has to go into a runoff with Democrat Jim Martin. And I would like to believe that the Democrats are going to give him a great deal of support and possibly win that seat back.
Well, I certainly hope so. Let me ask you a question. It's a rhetorical question. I would be willing to bet dollars against donuts that Jim Martin is not going to bring up or will not focus extensively upon the kind of campaign that Chambliss ran to win the election the first time, in which he said what he said about Cleland. Now, that to me is symptomatic of something that's a great weakness of our country that is paraded usually as a great strength. And that is, we don't look backwards. We only look forwards. We're ahistorical, don't care about history, and when people bring up history, they're told that's yesterday's news. Think about what we're going to do now and going forward.
Some of that nonsense from Sarah Palin during the vice presidential debate, where she was berating Biden for looking backwards, when in fact, if you don't understand where problems have arisen, how we've come to be where we are, it's virtually impossible to devise solutions that are going to be effective.
Well, not only is that true, and of course, I imagine, Jim, that based on what you necessarily read for the program that I've been on, you know that I feel as you do in spades about that. But I want to talk for just a brief moment about something very elemental.
Yeah.
You don't look backwards enough to excoriate and punish those who have said and done evil. People will continue to say and do evil.
Yeah.
That's just the law of life.
Well, in that election in Georgia where Max Cleland was turned out, very contrary to the traditions of Georgians who tend to vote in governors and senators and support them indefinitely, you know, for multiple terms, there were obvious problems with the electronic voting machines where machine after machine was returning the same number. It was a pattern that was repeating itself that was clearly indicative of a software glitch involving manipulation of the program to secure a predetermined result.
Tell me something. It's really shocking.
You know, why these Democrats are so spineless, Dean, is beyond me. I mean, you know, I have been acutely disappointed that up until now, the Democrats don't seem to have found their capacity to stand up against evil.
Well, you know, I have a thought about that. It's probably not right, and it's probably sort of biased in reverse. But I can't help wondering whether Democrats have been rendered courage-free by the fact that military service and being in favor of military solutions has been so much the conventional wisdom in this country since 1950. And Democrats often are not for the military solution, the physical solution. And I think they feel a little, I mean, my theory is, I don't know if there's any merit to the theory, that they feel a little bit abashed about their unwillingness to adopt a physical solution. I think there is a reason, and I think this may be the reason, why people like football players and military men are so heavily Republican. And the Democrats did not even have the courage. I finally realized this and rebelled. I've called myself a liberal for the last 2 years now because I've always been a liberal. But as you know, the Democrats spinelessly gave up the word and began calling themselves progressives.
Yeah.
That's just another example of being courage-free.
Yes. Yes, I reaffirm the word liberal. I like to say that that I believe that everyone deserves representation, not just the rich, as a defining characteristic of what it is to be liberal.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, it's distressing. I mean, it's a great word. This whole nation is a liberal concept. The idea of a democratic republic, checks and balances, all men being equal under the law, women too, obviously. I mean, it's a liberal nation in its essence. So if you give up that notion, you're really abandoning the high ground from a moral and linguistic point of view.
I agree with that.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Dean Lawrence of Belleville, and we'll be joined by Shannon Moore and Mark Adams. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo.
Hello, hello.
Your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today, Dean Lawrence Belleville of the University of Massachusetts School of Law, and I are being joined now by Shannon Moore, who's a talk show host in Alaska, who's been paying attention to the polls and noticing a lot of funny business taking place, and Mark Adams, who is JD MBA, founder of ProjectVoteCount.com, And I thought it would be very interesting for the dean, who's politically very sophisticated, to hear what Shannon has to say about what's taking place in Alaska, which Shannon, incidentally, has been picked up. Your article has been picked up and run by the Huffington Post, where it's obviously going to get a great deal of attention. And I noticed an article in the New York Times today, Stevens hanging on by a thread in Alaska as the ballot counting continues, the key paragraph of which says, "No senator has been expelled since the Civil War," said Donald Ritchie, a Senate historian. "Of 11 senators who've been indicted for crimes, 5 have been convicted, including Mr. Stevens," Mr. Ritchie said. "None have been reelected after being convicted." And yet, the way in which the polls are going, it looks as though that might happen with Senator Stevens. It's a pleasure to have Shannon Moore back to the show. Shannon, are you with me?
I'm with you. Thank you.
Absolutely terrific. And Mark Adams, are you there, Mark?
Yes, sir.
Let me just mention something in background. I went to realpolitics.com, realqueerpolitics.com, and discovered some early polling that was showing that, in fact, the Begich, who's running against Stevens, was leading by as much as 22 points prior to the election. That's fairly astonishing, because now, Shannon, what are the latest results? Stevens is hanging in there by a percent and a half or so?
Yeah, I think that is about what it is, about a percent and a half difference. And really, I mean, I started looking at this, and of course I was disappointed just from my own political stance of what was being shown. But what I started looking at was that we had actually thousands less Alaskans voting in 2008 than 2004.
Yes.
And it didn't add up. It still doesn't add up. And the Huffington Post, yeah, it's on their front page. The Atlantic has put it out. Washington Post is covering it. It's just phenomenal how many people have picked up this story. And I'm really glad they're paying attention. I think this is fundamentally, this isn't a Republican or Democrat sort of issue. This is about being American and about, you know, the integrity of our elections.
Well, you did good, girl, and I'm just delighted. I had the both of you on earlier this week, so we were talking about some of these political issues, and I was discussing with Mark how I was simply astonished that they hadn't done more to steal this election, and Mark was pointing out to me that it appeared to him that they really had used their voting machines to tap down, to suppress the amount of actual victory to save House seats and probably some Senate seats, too. Mark, that continues to be your view, does it not? Yet here in Alaska, we seem to have a microcosm of the problem in a state where the population is small enough that I think we might actually be able to expose the charade.
Oh, I would agree with you, Jim, because if they've actually kept a lot of the votes that were cast from showing up in the results, that will be one of the easiest tricks to expose. I mean, basically all you have to do there is go in and get the poll registers and compare them with the number of votes cast.
Well, the whole state only has a few hundred thousand voters, so I think it's really a case where it could be completely manageable. Shannon, you had some astute observations about how the percentages are remarkably like those of previous races. Why don't you comment on that?
Well, they're actually identical. And what sort of threw me initially was that they were identical from the get-go. They're identical to the Bush-Kerry election that we had here. It was a 61% of the vote went to George Bush, 37 went to John Kerry. And that was a pretty substantial turnout of voters that year in 2004. So we have the exact same margin, 61-36, but we had tens of thousands less voters on a year that we had 1,700% increases on our at our Democratic caucuses. We've had three of the biggest political rallies we've ever had in Alaska's state history. We had 12% of people show up to the primary over what had previously in August. That was before Sarah Palin was nominated. She had an 80% approval rating when she was nominated. It's hard for me to believe that 30,000 Alaskans who came out and voted for John Kerry just sat home this time, just sat it out for Barack Obama, and that 50,000 Alaskans that came out 4 years ago and voted for George Bush stayed home this time and didn't vote for Sarah Palin.
So that split that's being repeated, you're saying, is that the split for Obama versus McCain versus Obama, so that McCain is prevailing, or is it the Stevens-Murgich vote?
No, this is on the presidential level.
On the presidential level. So you're finding evidence that the presidential vote has been stolen, not just the senatorial, because as I mentioned to you earlier, it seems to me the repetition of that same percentage indicates that they're reusing the same software program they used in the past. Would you be inclined to agree with that, Mark?
Oh, I would agree with you. It sounds awfully fishy, and it looks like it's got the same programmed results to me, too, because, I mean, realistically, it's just completely unbelievable that it would be the same margin in this election as it was in 2004.
And as Shannon observes, with a lesser turnout, like what, 11% less? Is that right, Shannon, that there's fewer voters turning out when you have these mass rallies and there's more intense interest in this election probably than any in living memory?
Yes, that's exactly. I mean, to say that 11% of Alaskans who showed up to vote in 2004 just couldn't be motivated enough with their own governor if they're Republican. I mean, frankly, I'm surprised that it isn't more, you know, in the percent for Sarah Palin, just out of nostalgia or something. I'm not trying to, like, steal the vote back for Barack Obama and get him
sure.
the three electoral votes. What I'm saying is that there are votes missing from every indication I can find. And so I want to know where they are. And it doesn't matter to me what they say on them, who people voted for. It's, you know, it's a United States election, not, you know, one party or the other. But this is just this just really smells foul.
I'm just so proud of you for paying attention to this and writing it up, because you wrote a superb little piece, which I submitted to Op-Ed News, but I don't know if they've put it up yet. The Huffington Post has carried it, and you say also The Atlantic. That's sensational. It's going to get a huge amount of attention.
It has, and you know, Andrew Sullivan, I think, put it up, and he's, you know, he's done a lot of growing in the last year or so, and just watching, you know, how people are like, just looking at the map that I put out, and I really hyperlinked it. Just so people could see, you know, here it takes people right back to the Division of Elections, their official web pages, and it doesn't line up, and it's hard to argue math.
Mark, we had 1,100 attorneys for Obama here in Wisconsin. Do you have any idea how many there might be in Alaska?
No idea.
I have yet to meet one.
Do we see an exodus, a lot of attorneys climbing on the plane to get up there? Because if we don't do that, I'm going to be completely disgusted with the Democratic Party.
Well, I wouldn't expect much out of the Democratic Party, unfortunately. They did nothing whatsoever to help in the 2006 contest out of Florida, where we went door to door and got affidavits from the voters showing, without a doubt, at least 14% of the votes were stolen from the congressional candidates.
Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guest, Dean Belville, and our two additional guests, Mark Adams and Shannon Moore, when we get back. And Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. By extraordinary good fortune, I have three marvelous guests today. Mark Adams, the founder of Project Vote Count. Shannon Moore, who is a very smart radio talk show host from Alaska. And Lawrence Belville, the dean of the Massachusetts School of Law. We're talking about apparent evidence of election theft in Alaska at the presidential and the senatorial level. Dean Belville, I'd be interested in your reflections on what you've heard already about the situation.
Well, based on what your other two guests have said, and I read Shannon's article earlier today, I'd say that I have four questions. They seem to have what lawyers call a prima facie case, which is to say the facts are very suspicious, but you don't yet have the evidence as to how, as to precisely what happened, how it happened, and who did it. So you've got a prima facie case. They, we have been talking about people manipulating. The word they was used. Well, as usual, one question is, who is this they? Another question is, who can, will, or would investigate this, including would Begich or somebody, some of the other people who are harmed sue, and will an investigation occur as part of a lawsuit? And also, what are the presuppositions here as to how this could have been done? Who had who installed the software, who manipulated it? Where was it manipulated from? You know, what are the suppositions about all of it?
Well, those are excellent questions, of course. Mark, let me invite you to give a preliminary answer to the extent you feel comfortable doing so.
Well, I feel very comfortable. Basically, I wouldn't expect much in the way of an investigation by the state or by the parties, but certainly the candidates who are in the contest would have standing to contest these before Congress. They would more than likely have standing to contest them in court in Alaska, and citizens may be able to contest them in court in Alaska.
And that would include Barack Obama.
That would, but it would be highly unlikely that he would bother contesting it, since it doesn't affect the outcome of the election for him.
But it's far more likely that Begich would dispute it.
Right. The race for senator and congressman, obviously both of those races are something that could be questioned, and it sounds like, I mean, when you look at the information Shannon presented in her article, and she mentioned a little while ago, it sounds like certainly something funny went on. And, you know, to me, looking at it, it looks like there might be a few different tactics used to rig the outcome. And that's something that we're seeing, you know, across the board for years. There are several different tactics ranging from voter suppression to programming the vote to flip or the computer to flip a certain amount of votes. And here it looks like they may have figured that they needed to eliminate a certain number of votes in order to, you know, keep a win in place for Stevens and the other Republican in Congress.
Well, I'm so struck by the sameness of the gap, the difference in the vote, that it suggests to me that they use the same software program they used before.
Right, I'd agree with you there. You know, that sounds extremely unusual. I mean, of course, people could explain that you know, by saying everyone in Alaska is very partisan and they made the same decisions in this election as they made in 2004. I don't think that would really hold water. But as I mentioned earlier, the first thing people could do, or the first thing I would do, is I would try to go in and take a look at the actual poll registers in an area and check to see whether or not the number of voters who signed in to vote matches with the total votes cast in a number of precincts.
I think Shannon observed that there were funny factors in relation to the numbers too, that they were not adding up, or they even exceeded the actual possible vote in some of these cases.
Right. Well, I think that was, she was talking about there in the article about 2004. But in this election, what she's talking about is across the country, we had record turnouts for this election, with the exception, like Shannon pointed out, of Alaska. And
yeah,
Earlier today when she talked, Arizona. Now, isn't that unusual that the states where the Republican ticket, you know, McCain
would be most embarrassed.
Right. And would be embarrassed, you're right, first of all. But historically, usually when there's, you know, the state who has someone from that state running for president or vice president, usually has a bigger turnout than normal. And,
And
so they're bucking lots of trends in Arizona and Alaska, and it just seems, like the dean said, to be a prima facie case of something going wrong.
In both states. Now, the dean, of course, raised the first question, namely, who is they? Where are we going to pin the tail? You know, which donkey?
Well, there's a bunch of donkeys, and one of the donkeys, of course, is the three election machine manufacturers. I don't know which machines are in place in Alaska. It might be a state that has, you know, all three of the major manufacturers, or it might be a state with, like, South Carolina that has solely
ESNS. We have Diebold and ESNS. We have the optical scanners.
Okay, so you have the optical scanners, so you actually have paper that...
Do you have paper ballots then, Shannon?
Yes, we do have paper ballots, and that's why...
This is perfect. This is perfect.
Well, except, you know, I mean, I was talking to one of the local news reporters who came here today to do a story on this, and, you know, I run into him at all these events, different rallies, the caucus, the primaries, all these sort of political things, and we were talking earlier about what a great story this was, that we were blowing out the early voter record. You know, 4 years ago, 11,000 people had voted in the entire time that it was open. And, you know, with 4 days before, 4 days left to early vote, we had already exceeded 15,000. So we were talking about just how historic this was and how exciting it was for Alaska that so many people were engaged and that neither one of us knew anyone that wasn't voting. And so that's why he's following the story, because it's like, okay, we have paper ballots. We have people show up. Where's the paper? Where are the votes? Because I seriously don't know anyone who is either. I mean, Sarah Palin's very polarizing, and people are either voting for her or against her. So is Barack Obama. And so you look at that and you say, wow, well, I would have expected at least what we had in 2004, but we're 11 percentage points down from that.
You should be probably 20% above it. Stand by. We'll be right back with my special guests, Shannon Moore, Mark Adams, and Lawrence Belville of the University of Massachusetts School of Law.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guests during this extraordinary hour include Mark Adams, who's the founder of Project Vote Count, Shannon Moore, who's an Alaskan talk show host who's been noticing what's been going on up there in terms of voting irregularities, and Lawrence Belville, the dean of the University of Massachusetts School of Law. Mark, let me ask, it seems to me this is a perfect situation if you have paper ballots and optical scanners where you could prove conclusively fraud using these electronic machines.
Well, I think agree. There are two very simple things that could be done. One, which doesn't involve the ballot per se, is if Alaska is like it's done in New Hampshire where I live, when somebody walks into the polling place and wants to vote, they check you off. So all you have to do is count up the number of people who were checked off, compare that to the number of ballots supposedly cast, and right away you have a ready notion of whether all the ballots have been counted. The other thing is to actually count the number of paper ballots, presuming, as I do, and as occurred in Florida, that until everything is all done and over with, they keep the ballots. You could simply count them, and see how many you've got. And or, I don't know what they do with the unused ballots, but probably they just throw them out. But if they don't, if they have to return them somewhere, you can count how many were unused. So there are a lot of really simple ways to calculate whether or not there were votes that were not counted.
Mark, isn't the dean's delineating some of the techniques that could be used? I'm sure you can imagine others. What do you think? Is this a perfect situation to prove a case?
Well, yeah, the dean's certainly correct there. I mean, I would agree. The first thing I would do, since it looks like there were voters who turned out and then had no vote registered for them, the easiest way would be checking the poll registers versus the number of votes reported in a number of precincts. And it, obviously, if you see a pattern where, so let's say, the poll register is showing 20 or 25% more people showing up at the polls than the number of votes cast, then you've got what I would term as the stupidest manipulation of an election ever in history. But then the next thing is going in and looking at the actual paper ballots. And there's a couple problems with that. In the Busby versus Bilbray contest in California out of 2006, Paul Leto was the attorney handling that congressional election contest. And they had paper ballots, but the court refused, first of all, the supervisor of elections, or whatever California's term for the election official, refused to produce them. And the court refused to require the elections officials to produce them.
You're kidding me.
No, I'm not kidding you. And, of course, that's completely absurd, but that's the type of decisions we have in cases where we're talking about election fraud. The
most
judiciary
basic elementary relevant evidence isn't admitted?
Right. It's you're not even allowed to discover it. So it's just outrageous, and you know that goes into the problem we're having with our judiciary being completely out of control too.
Dean, don't you find this stupefying that there would be a decision of that kind by a judge?
Well, there's an old phrase which I think applies. I'm shocked but not surprised.
Takes us back to Casablanca, right? Stunning stuff, Shannon. Tell me more. You know, what's going on there? You're getting a lot of responses, I gather. People have been calling you ever since you were making a point of this matter.
Yeah, they have been. And locally, I mean, nationally, certainly it's getting some attention just because people are probably more familiar with it. But locally, I mean, to have the number one news station in Anchorage that's shown all over the state call me and say, there's something to this story. You know, that's some good traction. And I can tell you, I really think that Alaskans, I would defend to have, you know, everybody's vote counted. But it's just really suspect to think that, you know, 11%, that's just not going to roll with people.
Well,
they know
Alaska's
better.
So small, you could interview every single voter in Alaska and prove what happened here.
You know, I think I have. No, I'm kidding. I haven't. But, we have a pretty small community here. But it's hard to think that, you know, up to 30,000 people who felt that they were progressive enough in 2004 to vote for John Kerry would stay home in this election.
Oh, it's absurd. I mean, you're pointing out these gross discrepancies in the situation. As the dean observed, you have a prima facie case. There's no doubt about it. The question is going further and putting together enough evidence to bring an indictment, and there you have to target a particular individual who's going to be held responsible for the crime that's being committed.
Well, you know, and that's part of what's been really great about you and other people in the national media picking this up, because, you know, I'm just a girl from Homer. I'm not a statistician. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know how all of this stuff works, but I know it's been really stinky in Alaska the last couple of elections. We've had to sue before, and this is just about ridiculous.
Well, I think it's wonderful that I've had you on a couple times. And the last time we had Bob Fitrakis on with the last half hour, so that I think in a way it was sensitizing you to the range of possibilities here with regard to election fraud.
Yeah, and when you think of this, I mean, it is really valuable to the country because as a country, we're 5 seats away from a 60-seat supermajority in the Senate. And for both sides are desperate to have those things. And you look at, I mean, I'm seeing a lot of comments on my pages about Georgia right now. And that they think the same thing has happened there. So, you know, this should matter to the entire country. And regardless of even if it didn't have any effect on the supermajority or not, these are Americans who voted, who stood in line at 20 degrees for over an hour in some cases to vote. And what are we fighting for? What are we living for and loving for if it's not that vote to, you know, we're each one? It's just really important.
Well, many of us as Americans regard our right to vote as our most precious legacy. And if we're stolen, if we're deprived of that right, then it really is forfeiting what it means to us to be an American.
Exactly. If democracy was a religion, voting would be the sacrament, you know.
Mark, Dean Velville, do either of you have ideas about, you know, what buttons to push? It seems to me this has to be brought to the attention of the Democratic Party, maybe Howard Dean. Howard Dean might be somebody who should be advised of this. I wouldn't be surprised if you know him, Dean Velville.
He would be surprised. No, I do not know.
Can we push some buttons? I mean, something has to be done here, you know.
Yeah, well, I have nothing to add to that. I think the question really that Alaskans, people like Shannon should be addressing now is whom do we put the heat on to bring lawsuits and or indictments?
In Alaska, Shannon, is the Attorney General appointed by the governor?
The Attorney General is appointed by the governor, and, you know, I don't think he's going to be happy to see me. The last time I was in his office, I was delivering a petition to ask for him to step down because he had advised state employees to break the law and not show up for subpoenas. He is appointed by Governor Palin, and with the whole Troopergate investigation, he's also having bar complaints put against him for breaking the law.
Yeah, about members of the legislature, it seems to me they are much more responsible, law-abiding, and objective about these matters. Surely there has to be an entity in Alaska that could take steps to investigate this and expose it.
I think there are.
We'll be right back with my special guests, Mark Adams, Shannon Moore, and Lawrence Velville, Dean of the University of Massachusetts School of Law.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
The Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guests this hour have been Mark Adams, who's the founder of Project Vote Count, and an attorney, Dean Lawrence Velville of the University of Massachusetts School of Law, and Shannon Moore, who's a talk show host who's been paying attention to what's going on in Alaska, and frankly, it stinks. Mark, let me ask you the question I was approaching at the end of the last segment, to wit, what can we do here to pursue this? Because it seems to me to be an ideal situation to clamp down and be able to prove exactly what happened here.
Well, like the dean suggested, the first thing I'd do is go in and look at the poll registers and compare them with the official number of votes cast in the particular precincts. And you could just take a county or two and start with just a few precincts in each of those counties. And then I would also see if I could get in to look at the actual paper ballots and count them for a few particular precincts and then compare them with the totals. And actually, you should be able to go in and look at the paper ballots and count them But that freedom has been restricted in just about every state. So I'm not sure whether or not public records law or Freedom of Information Act law and election law for Alaska would allow that. But that would be the first thing I would look at, as seeing what you can do as a citizen without starting any type of legal proceeding to go in and just review the documents.
You don't think that the Obama people or the Democratic Party ought to send a team of attorneys out there and turn the place inside out?
Well, in the Florida election contest, I mean, we were contesting four congressional elections, the governor's election for the state of Florida, and the Democratic Party would not even inform their members of our contest. And before we even filed the contest, we had gathered affidavits from voters in a precinct in John Russell's district showing that the official vote count did not include all the votes cast for him. And, you know, we gathered more information and showed that there was a similar flip in Clint Curtis's district as there was in John Russell's district. And all those, I mean, the Democratic Party would not do anything to help us. Now, they supported the Sarasota election contest where Kendall Coffey and attorneys from the ACLU and PFAW actually filed contests, did not ask for jury trials, rolled over on the trade secret issue, did nothing in the way that, like we suggested to them, going door to door in a few precincts and actually asking the voters to testify as to how they voted so that they could compare what the voters said with what the machine said. And so, you know, I mean, I would certainly put pressure on all these people to try and help, but I wouldn't expect much from them.
God, that's disheartening. I mean, I can't believe it. You're telling me these are all chicken-livered and spineless, you know, public servants who are actually betraying the public interest?
Yeah, that's what I'm telling you. They're all bought and paid for by the same people that have been running the show for a long, long time.
Dean, can you see a way of working around this?
Well, a couple of thoughts have come to me. They probably suffer from the same deficiencies Mark has identified. But, you know, number one, for laughs, so to speak, it's a little-known fact, because the Supreme Court has never seen fit to use the clause that the Constitution says that the United States, meaning the federal government, shall guarantee to each state a republican form of government. And what is being assailed here, if what Shannon has found out, and if the prima facie case is true, is that people have taken illegal steps to destroy the republican form of government in Alaska. And I don't. That's just a philosophical and constitutional point, not a practical one necessarily. But I don't think it should be forgotten. And in terms of a practical things to do, well, I think you've got at least two things that are conceivable. If the publicity keeps growing and gets bigger and bigger, Congress has every right under its constitutional responsibilities to launch an investigation of this. And also the Department of Justice, or shall I say the Department of Injustice, makes a practice of investigating voter fraud cases. This is a species of voter fraud and fraud on the electorate. And after the administration changes on January 20th, it seems to me that this is a very fit matter for the Department of Justice.
So there's not going to be a statute of limitations that we're going to have to confront here that's going to run out anytime soon.
Well, there is a statute of limitations, but you know, certainly it's not going to run out before there's time to investigate. Unfortunately, the evidence will be tampered with if you don't act quickly.
Yeah.
Because like we saw in Ohio in 2004, they rigged the recount to match the initial count, and so that is the nature of the public servants. The people who perpetrated the crime are going to try and cover the crime up. And they have all the evidence in their control right now.
So what we need to have is an impounding of all the ballots and the optical scanning machines and everything else related to this.
Well, what I would suggest is get in once again and try and go to, if Shannon knows an election supervisor in a particular area and they seem honest and you know, I would go to them and say, hey, we want to see some of these records because we're concerned about this. And you know, hopefully Alaska's public records law doesn't exempt ballots from disclosure and treat them as state secrets.
Well, you know, if I may ask the question, Mark, what do you mean by saying, I mean, I'm not clear on exactly what you mean by saying we want to see some of these ballots. Why couldn't you just go to them and say, tell us how many ballots you have and how many people registered? And do the two corroborate?
Right, right.
Now, I mean, they can tell you the truth or they can lie. In which case, if you go forward, you might have some kind of, depending on who asked the question, you could have a perjury case.
But see, I've asked that question, and it's published. You know, since 2004, we've had 21,000 people sign up to vote. So that's the increase. And then, we know how many people we have registered to vote, and then we know how many ballots that they say that they have. And so when they tell us that we have tens of thousands of less ballots than we do, you know, cast in this election than we did in 2004, that's where it just jacks up on me. It's just not possible.
Right. Well, that's your prima facie case. But to make a case that stands up in court, you have to know not just how many people registered to be voters, but how many people walked into the polling place that day, which they do keep track of.
Right, they do keep track of that, and that's what I'm talking about getting. You go in, and it's commonly called the poll register. It's where the people sign in at the polling place when they go to vote. And you look at the poll registers, you know, you can ask for copies of them, or you can look at the original and count them, and you know, maybe videotape it, have somebody with you, then swear affidavit saying, we counted this poll register at this precinct in wherever, Alaska, and it showed 1,000 people signed in to vote, yet the official results show only 750 people voted. I mean, obviously there, that shows a serious problem. And then if you say, let me see all the ballots from this precinct, and you count them, and there's 1,000 ballots there, then obviously, somehow or other, the machine was set to ignore a percentage of ballots. And the other thing you may find is you may find 750 ballots there, which indicates that someone in the election official's office has made 250 disappear, because obviously, once again, if you have 1,000 people sign in to vote in a precinct, it doesn't make sense that they don't have ballots for each one of those people.
It seems to me there's an ideal situation here to actually prove that election theft has been taking place in the state of Alaska. Shannon, I want to compliment you. I'm very proud of you, girl. You're doing good. Dean Belville, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Mark, you're doing great work. I want to thank you all. And if anything any of you can do to deal with this, I'd be grateful. So would the nation itself as a whole. Thank you all for coming on the show, and I want to thank everyone out there for listening. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo.